This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Brustein, has made an impact on American theater as a critic, producer, director, and teacher. In 1966, Brustein became the dean of the Yale School of Drama. He established the Yale Repertory Theater and served as its artistic director for 13 years. From Yale, he went to Harvard, where he created the American Repertory Theater, which he continues to direct. The celebrated alumni of the Harvard and Yale programs include Christopher Walken, Sigourney Weaver, Christopher Durang, and Meryl Streep. Christopher Lloyd is starring in Brustein's current production of Strindberg's The Father. In Brustein's capacity as theater critic for The New Republic, Brustein has taken many provocative positions. In a review of one of Václav Havel's plays several years ago, Brustein wrote that he was reluctant to write about Havel's work because political considerations can inhibit one's critical judgments. While Havel's status recently changed from dissident playwright to the president of Czechoslovakia, he's in Washington this week to meet with President Bush and address a joint session of Congress. I asked Robert Brustein if he sees Havel's rise to power as a statement about the political relevance of art and artists.
I think that in Europe, there's always been a significant relevance to art and artists. Clearly, European countries and the Soviet Union has responded quite violently to the dicta and conclusions of artists, and quite often has imprisoned them, which signifies the power of the written word over there. I don't think in this country we've as yet achieved anywhere near the potency of art in relation to the society that we live in.
Now, from what I've read of yours, you're actually not a big fan of Havel's plays.
Well, I respect and admire them. I think that the political component in them does tend at times, I won't say to get didactic, but that he is such a heroic figure, and he is quite often the hero of his own work, that he must work extra hard not to turn himself into a self-adulating figure. He does that with extreme deftness, but you feel the contortions that he's going through in order to make his point about the repressiveness of the society and yet not heroicize himself in relation to that society. So he goes into pretzel contortions doing that, and as a result, I think that may affect the disinterestedness of the work.
I think a lot of us have become very curious about Havel's work, and I think most Americans haven't read it or seen it performed. Would you give us like a basic introduction to his plays?
Well, it's hard to give a little capsule version of his plays, but and I haven't read all of them, to tell you the truth, but the ones I know generally do follow fairly much in the pattern of Beckett, to whom he pays homage, and it's significant that Beckett pays homage to Havel as well. I don't know of any other writer that he does that he did that in relation to. Insofar as his work generally takes place in one of two places, either unspecified, vague location where there is a repression going on, and a group of secret policemen, say, are trying to batter down a door and interrogate an individual inside the room, or in the specified Czechoslovakian living room or prison where Havel himself has spent a good deal of time. And I think it's safe to say that virtually all of his plays have to do with how one responds inside a repressive society, not just the artist, but any individual. And what you do when your friends are caving into that repression and collaborating with it.
In a review that you wrote a couple of years ago of one of his plays, and it was a play that you were critical of, you wrote that it was really a dilemma. How does one criticize the art of an exemplary man?
Yes, one has this problem with Fugard as well. I think they're very similar. Athol Fugard, the South African, and Havel, the Czechoslovakian writers, both are what I call saints of the theater. They're very saintly human beings. And the work they're doing has a very powerful moral and political purpose. But obviously I think that it falls short of being great art, perhaps as a result of the fact that the purpose is overwhelmingly moral and political rather than artistic.
Would you be likely to stage Havel now, given how he's become president of his country? Or would you make that decision purely on what you thought of the play?
I think we'd have to, which is not to say we don't do plays that that are relevant to one's particular time and place. It's very important that we do that kind of play. But I wouldn't do any play simply because someone has become president of the country. I wouldn't do the plays of the Pope, for example, simply because he writes plays as well. I think we would have to feel that the play was an important one for our company and for our audience. And for that reason, other than its convenience at the time, that would be the best reason to put it on. And I'm sure Havel's going to get innumerable productions now all over the country and will be possibly the most well-produced playwright in America over the next year or two.
One more question about Havel. Has Havel's work been very popular in Eastern Europe or in the States here?
Well, as far as I know, Havel's work has not been done in Eastern Europe. There's any number of plays that he's written that he's never seen himself. He just went, I think, to Finland to see the first production of one of his plays. It wasn't the first production of the play, but for him, it was the first time he'd ever seen the play. His plays have been done, not very often in the United States. I think the public theater, Joe Papp's Public Theater, is taking the lead in staging his plays. They are generally received with respect, but not a great deal of enthusiasm or popularity. That is undoubtedly destined to change.
Are you cynical when you say that?
No, not at all. I'm not being cynical. Naturally, I think that a playwright's work should be determined on the basis of its quality rather than any circumstances surrounding the playwright. But Havel certainly deserves to be seen, and so any way he can get his plays seen, I'm fully in favor of.
Now, you've staged some political theater in your time, even in the late 60s when you were first at the Yale Repertory Theater. You did McBird and Viet Rock, two anti-war plays. And in a book you wrote about that period, you described them as maybe politically shallow but important cathartic experiences. How did you weigh that, if you thought the plays were lacked a certain political depth, but they'd really matter in the lives of the people who saw it?
Well, first a correction. We did not produce McBird. That was produced off-Broadway in 1966.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me.
Not at all, but we did produce Viet Rock, and that did not turn out to be quite as textured as I had hoped it might be and as I thought it was going to be from the studio work I'd seen preparatory to the actual full production. My own feeling in answer to your question is that I think virtually every great play has some political component, and you can't escape it. The question is whether the ideological component becomes its overriding purpose, and if the art or the complexity or the subtlety of the presentation takes a back seat to the ideology, however appropriate or satisfying that ideology may be to certain people. I think it's not destined to last if the ideology is paramount, if the thematic thrust is paramount and it's not supported by sufficient artistic tie beams.
Robert Brustein is my guest, and he's the founder and artistic director of the American Repertory Theater at Harvard. He also founded the Yale Repertory Theater, and his current production at the American Repertory Theater is Strindberg's The Father, which will run through March 18th. Many artists and writers and people and nonprofit arts groups are concerned that the National Endowment for the Arts has become politicized. There's a new guideline for NEA applications saying that the NEA can't fund work that's considered obscene, including sadomasochism, homoeroticism, the sexual exploitation of children or individuals engaged in sex acts, unless the material has serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Do you consider that censorship? And do you think that, well, let me let you answer that question first.
I do consider that borderline censorship. I think it is an infringement of First Amendment rights, and I know there are people who will dispute this, saying that you're not censoring a play simply if you're not funding it, or any work of art. But in our country, since it's so hard to find funds for works of art, and since the National Endowment was founded precisely for the purpose of providing money to artists who normally could not get it through commercial means, since they're not creating entertainment or popular works, I think this does de facto function as a form of censorship and infringement of the First Amendment right.
What does serious artistic value mean to you? I mean, there is that clause, you know, that the NEA won't fund this stuff unless the materials have serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value.
I think it's a contradiction in terms. If whatever is considered obscene is inside a work of art, then it has artistic value. It seems like a redundancy to me, or a tautology.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who determines this, how it's determined. It seems to me that we're setting up a whole number of literary critics and critics of art among people who have no experience of it. They're not qualified, they're not trained to criticize art. I mean, Jesse Helms is hardly our most advanced art critic, nor are any other members of Congress that I know, and certainly the Supreme Court is not in a position to make these determinations. I think the best judge of the quality of the art and its social purpose is the panel group that functions in each of the NEA divisions that determines whether the institution or the artist is worthy of receiving a grant. And that's a panel group of peers made up of a large number of variety of people from the arts and surrounding areas. And I still know of no better method than the peer group review by the panels. And to take the authority away from the panels, I think, is seriously to undermine the authority of the NEA and one's confidence in it as a functioning institution.
You disagree with the validity of this new guideline. You at least once served on an NEA panel. Would you serve again as long as this guideline remains?
No, I would not. Frankly, I would find this a highly restrictive guideline, and I think it's an insulting guideline to a number of artists as well. It's infantile, and it has put us back about, God knows, 30 or 40 years in our standing in relation to other nations. We're just looking like a bunch of adolescents here, where our values and our morality is determined by network television and its values and morality.
Are there plays that you've staged in the past that you think might be challenged now because of sadomasochism, homoeroticism? You know?
Well, I think that guideline, which is a revised version of the Helms Amendment, Sidney Yates introduced the proviso that this have, you know, literary or scientific or artistic value. But nevertheless, to put homoerotic art in with sadomasochism and mutilation of children and God knows what else they've got there as a list of criminal intents, I think is a serious insult to the homosexual community. Certainly there are plays that we have done that have included homosexuals or been about homosexuals or been written by homosexuals, which we consider works of considerable merit. We are about to do a play by Arthur Kopit that I think is one of the funniest plays I've read in many years, called The Road to Nirvana, and that undoubtedly will break just about every rule that has been set down by this amendment, outside of the fact that it has artistic value, it has great artistic value. But I think all our hands will be tied if we have to adjudicate every work of art we get according to guidelines. Artists don't function this way, and I fear that the way they're going to respond is to get more provocative rather than less. I mean, that's what one tends to do when one gets painted into a corner. You get provocative. You start waving a red flag at the people who obviously start salivating when they see one.
You say you fear that artists will get more provocative. What would be wrong with that? Why do you fear it?
Well, I don't think this is the nature of, you know, I think we were off on a detour. It's not the nature of our work to go around provoking Jesse Helms and his ilk. It really debases and lowers the aspirations of the artist and brings him down to the level of a very second-rate Puritan.
You've written, "In my profession, there's nothing more alienating than going to a smash hit and not being able to share the good time that everyone seems to be having." Has that happened to you lately?
It happens fairly frequently, yes. Generally at the Socceroo, what I call schleppic musicals that Broadway's been turning out lately.
Give me a recent example.
Oh, Phantom of the Opera, I guess, is a good example. Cats. I'm not among the majority that respond to those ear-shaking musicals. I find the music is unsatisfying. It sounds like Puccini combined with Parmesan cheese. And the books are generally fatuous and silly. Well, and, you know, it doesn't please me to sit and watch chandeliers go up and down, which seems to be the main actor in this particular work.
So what's so alienating about not liking something when everybody around you is enjoying themselves like crazy?
Well, one of the great things about the theater is that it is a community. It's one of the last communities we have left. And it's interesting, you know, when you go to the theater, you don't want the seat next to you to be empty. You want to be next to somebody, which is different from when you want to go to the movies where you want a whole theater to yourself. You don't want anyone sitting next to you because you want to be alone with your fantasies. But in the theater, you really want to be part of something. You want to respond together. There's a kind of feeling of multitude that takes over. When you're sitting in a theater, and if you're sitting there glowering when everyone else is laughing, or if you're laughing when everyone else is glowering, you certainly feel alienated, you feel isolated.
Now, I know when you started at Yale, you really wanted to prevent your company from becoming a tryout house for Broadway. Do you still feel that way, and what's wrong with being used in part as a tryout house for Broadway?
I still do feel that way, even though a number of our productions have, with our blessing but without our participation, gone on to New York in one form or another. I think if you're in the business of transferring your productions, either through participation in them or actually, as is now happening, I see with some theaters producing them, nonprofit theaters are now producing plays on Broadway, you're violating some covenant that was created when nonprofit theaters were first formed. And that is that this was not to be a tributary or a stream that led to Broadway, but rather an alternative to the commercial theater. In the same way that PBS, say, or public television is an alternative to commercial television. It's not meant to compete with it. It's meant to be different so that a variety of tastes can be satisfied and not just one, that one big mass taste that is satisfied by commercial network television or its equivalent, the Broadway theater. So for us in the resident theater movement to start generating works and looking for works that might have a wider appeal on the Broadway stage is really, I think, a complete betrayal of our mandate. And I'm sorry to see it happen, and I think it's been responsible for the deterioration in our movement.
But isn't it good for Broadway when works get originated at regional theater?
Well, I'm sure it's good for Broadway, and certainly it's good for Broadway producers. They save a lot of money. And as a result, they have been paying a lot of money to theaters to do this sort of thing. But, you need a long spoon when you start stepping with some of these producers. And I think the spoon has gotten very short. It's true that Broadway has benefited from the appearance of the more serious play on the Broadway stage. On the other hand, it strikes me that the resident theaters have gotten much less daring in trying to produce that compromise between what they might do and what Broadway might do so that both can be satisfied. So what you have really is a situation in which the resident theater is no longer daring, is no longer innovating in the way that it used to in the 60s and 70s in many theaters, I would say most theaters in the country.
My guest is Robert Brustein, and he's the founder and artistic director of American Repertory Theater at Harvard. You started your career as a scholar and as an actor, but you gave up acting. Why?
Good question. I gave up acting really because I gave it up when I came to Cambridge. I didn't entirely give it up. Actually, I appeared in my own production of Tonight We Improvise as the director of that play, since I was the director of the play and I was almost required to play it. But it was a cowardly thing to do. Every time I put my face on stage, the local critics would throw ripe melons at it. So I felt I'd had enough and I stopped acting. I thought I could expose myself in other ways much more creatively.
Have you ever produced something that you knew was bad? Where the critic in you said, this is not a very good production, and you're stuck with it?
Very often, yes. Not too often, but often. this happens. There's always, you know, something in a production, whether it's mine or someone else's, which I'm unable to fix. I'm unable, let's say, to persuade the director to fix, and it bothers me. And there are productions and plays that I feel I've overestimated or something's gone wrong in the process. And I sit there and shiver a little at the result. And once, even with a play that I will leave unnamed, I actually cut short the run of the play because I thought the play was not finished and it was embarrassing to the theater and to the playwright for it to proceed. But other than that one time, we've always played out our runs, which are short runs, 32, 35 performances, and we stick with what we've done.
I've only left a few seconds for this, but is it a conflict of interest for you to be a producer and a critic?
There are times when these issues do arise. I know virtually three-quarters of the people that I review. They're people I've either worked with or taught or trained. It's very hard to be disinterested in this regard. And what I have to do is just bite the bullet and risk the friendship or not review the play. I do at least have the option of not reviewing the play or the actor or the director, as the case may be. There are cases when that arises, and I just have to face it head on and announce the conflict of interest and go ahead anyway.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about theater.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Robert Brustein is the founder and artistic director of the American Repertory Theater at Harvard, and his current production is Strindberg's The Father, which will run through March 18th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.